Good afternoon, everybody. I'd just like to acknowledge the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors and Julie Cross, the policy consultant who worked with them, Jennifer Talbot from the Kaiser Commission, Dr. Linda Ray Murray, and I also want to acknowledge our Senior Health Policy Advisor to Governor Quinn, who is here with us today, Michael Gelder, and our Assistant Director for the Illinois Department of Public Health, Teresa Garate. So, let's move on. Okay. We're going to try this. We'll try to be technologically advanced. Okay. I'm trying to work with three concepts in this presentation in terms of health reform to acknowledge the longstanding civil rights struggle, and we'll spend a little time talking about the history of that. We also want to look at the issues of health equity that, first of all, acknowledges inequality in society and using social determinants of health as a framework to address it, and then to look at the whole issue of HIV/AIDS programs and advocacy, and that it has taken into account issues of health reform and health equity. For a brief history, you know, in the United States, as far as the social safety net is concerned, the first actual federal support for people was to disabled veterans, widows, and orphans of the Civil War conflict. And while this is limited to a small part of the population, this was in much ways looked at as the beginnings of the implements of the Social Security Act that was passed in 1935. At that time, there was a concerted effort to have a health component to that, but that failed in the passage, and what we received was the Social Security Act without that. And also within what passed in Social Security was the exclusion of domestic and agricultural workers from benefits, and that went on to throughout the 1950s, and so it had an effect basically of de facto racial and economic disparity, which you could say might have an impact on where we are with health equity today. And as a result of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, Medicare and Medicaid were passed, which had an initially immediate effect on those eligible for those programs and lifting some people out of poverty and improved the quality of their lives. For health reform, going back again, we have the main push of the health reform movement is based on universal coverage to start to try and reach a future of health equity and social justice. What was passed in this, what we would still say landmark legislation this year, is an expansion of health insurance coverage that was hopefully a future of getting up to universal health coverage. It's a distinct difference, even though there is definite progress in terms of what was passed. So, in terms of what was passed into law, we know that it's the most far-reaching since the Medicaid and Medicare was passed in 1965, that it expands or makes improvements in existing systems, and the most significant changes will occur in 2014. According to the Congressional Budget Office, about 19% of the nation's population is uninsured now. They estimate that by 2019, it will leave about 8% uninsured. So that accounts to about 23 million people who they estimate will still be uninsured in 2019. And among these uninsured will be undocumented immigrants, people who are eligible for Medicaid for whatever reason will not be enrolled, people who will be exempt from the mandate, those who may pay a penalty in lieu of getting coverage, and it's an estimate that most will be low-income people. Health as a human right remains an issue. As we all know, there's an economic recession in the United States, and HIV in the United States and globally remains a social justice issue. Of the 33.4 million people worldwide living with HIV and AIDS, the vast majority are living in impoverished conditions. Of the 1.1 million people living in HIV/AIDS in the United States, the estimate of the CDC is that there are 56,300 new infections annually. Half people living with HIV in your country do not have reliable access to HIV care. 29% are uninsured, and 21% do not know that they're infected. In terms of the major challenges of health equity, from the World Health Organization report in 2008, is to focus in on improving daily living conditions, the circumstances in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. tackle inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources, and measure and understand the problem and assess the impact of action. So just a couple of examples of inequity as it relates to HIV and AIDS in the United States. In 2008, the Black AIDS Institute did a report and looked at African Americans in the United States, and you can imagine if African Americans were a country, they noted that that would reach about 600,000 African Americans living with HIV, up to 30,000 being infected each year. When looking at those kind of statistics, the report said the death rate is 2.5 times that of infected whites, and as a result, the hypothetical nation of Black America would rank below 104 other countries in life expectancy. It noted that more Black Americans are living with HIV and AIDS than the infected populations of 7 of the 15 countries that receive support from the U.S. Global AIDS Program. Another study this summer that was presented at the International AIDS Conference by the CDC looked at HIV and AIDS and poverty in the United States and noted that amongst the people in this study, the poorer they were, the more likely they were to be infected. And in this regard, the 9,000 people that they were interviewed, they also tested the people, and 188 people tested positive, 55% were women. Another situation in our country is the whole immigrant issue in our country, and the issue of HIV and AIDS as a result of immigrants, and particularly undocumented. The Ryan White Care Act in particular is accessible to all people regardless of their citizenship status in this country, and I would premise that no human being is illegal, and that immigration reform is a public health issue. Now, just a little bit about what the health reform does do to help people living with HIV, and I would argue all other people in the country as well. We know this basic issue that it will eliminate based on pre-existing conditions, extends dependent coverage under Medicare, particularly the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, that people living with HIV will be counted toward reducing this donut hole that needs to be closed. For Medicaid, which might be the greatest area where it will eventually benefit people living with HIV and AIDS, in that childless adults who are poor enough, 133% of poverty, will become eligible for Medicaid. Thus, that would potentially have a major impact on the Ryan White program, and that at least 50% of the people on ADEP, at least in our state, are under 200% of poverty. The good thing about this is that many people have comorbidities, other health conditions, and as a person is eligible for Medicaid, their access to pharmaceuticals and other treatments expands. For the HIV population and ADAP program, most of the medications are HIV-specific only and don't deal with issues of comorbidity. The other big area where it's potential great benefit to people living with HIV and AIDS is the expansion and resource infusion with community health centers around the country. Many community health centers are already facilities that provide HIV services. They do so under Ryan White. They are medical homes for people already, and the fact that they would be expanding would make that useful for people living with HIV and AIDS. And this is one of those arenas also where citizenship status is not a deterrent for getting care in these sites. When you look at funding for HIV and AIDS in the country, about 4% of the $24.8 billion in HIV and AIDS funding is for prevention. But if you look at the care and treatment side, about $6.2 billion is Medicaid, $4 billion is Medicare, and $2.2 billion is Ryan White. Now, the Ryan White Treatment Extension Act of 2009 was first enacted in 1990. It's the payer of last resort for people who don't qualify for any other things. It's been reauthorized 4 different times, and of note, the next reauthorization is 2013, 1 year before the Medicaid expansion takes place. Of the components in the Ryan White program, Part B is the major area where the AIDS Drug Assistance Program is. I'd just like to call your attention to 3 things under the Special Projects of National Significance. In the Special Projects of National Significance, major demonstration initiatives were conducted that helped shape how we handled two special, I would say, important populations insofar as HIV is concerned. One of them are demonstration projects that found it to be efficacious and useful to provide pre-discharge planning and seamless entry of seamless movement from prison and jail to the community for HIV-positive persons. That has shown to be significant and now is being acted in many places around the country today. Another area that was a demonstration project under this umbrella is the border programs that provides HIV care for persons along the Texas-Mexico border, not just Texas, but southern United States, southwestern United States-Mexico border, that makes it possible for people who often transition back and forth for each side of the border to get their care. That, too, has been found to be useful. And, of course, dental programs are available under Ryan White as well. The AIDS Drug Assistance Program serves currently about 200,000 people who have no other way to get their medications for this life-threatening disease. You can see that the overwhelming majority of people on the program are under 300% of poverty, and by 2009, about 77% of people were under 200% of poverty. There's a waiting list situation during this year, and right now there are 4,157 people on waiting lists in 8 states. Even after a $25 million infusion of additional funds this summer, it's still we still have waiting lists, and that's basically for 3 things. One, the good news is people are living longer with HIV and are alive to reapply every year. Number 2, routine testing has been successful. More people have been found to be HIV positive and brought into care. And number 3, unfortunately, many people living with HIV are working and have lost jobs or losing jobs and therefore losing their insurance benefits and then apply for ADAP and they're eligible. There are many Ryan White services in place that don't fit a medical model, and many would argue that that's precisely why the program has been successful. These wraparound services include real important structural benefits such as housing assistance, utility bill assistance, emergency cash assistance, as well as free legal assistance. There's also prevention programs that are maintained by health departments, as well as HIV counseling, testing, and behavioral interventions. So 2015 is the goal for the National AIDS Strategy goals to actually be achieved, reducing the number of people who are affected with HIV by 25%, increasing access to care, and reducing disparities. And in order to do that, it will be necessary to take into account the need to reauthorize the Ryan White Care Act program, but the 2014 expansion of Medicaid will be helpful, but I think that there will be people who will advocate, elected officials and others who may advocate to say that why do we need a Ryan White program reauthorized in 2013 if in 2014 the Medicaid expansion will take place as well as other elements of the Affordable Care Act that was passed. And it will not address the issues of undocumented immigrants. It may likely not be able to address appropriately the issues of people coming out of prison or anyone else who would not necessarily be able to get the health insurance issues. And then finally, in terms of meeting the targets that the National AIDS Strategy has put forth, would it not also be important to make sure that the Ryan White Care Act is in place? After all, this is a disparity-reducing program. So from moving from health reform to health equity, the issue is to take into account structural, behavioral, as well as preventive and medical care for people living with HIV and prevention as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mildred. So, you know, in this country, we're going to face a choice very soon. When we move toward more coverage, will we in fact scale these programs? Will we close them down? Or will we recognize that every American, insured or uninsured, needs the targeted outreach, needs patient navigation, needs wraparound services, case management, and quality assurance? And I would argue we have a real opportunity to provide better care for everyone and better health in the nation. The last thing I want to say for your questions is please don't take for granted that health reform is going to happen. and certainly don't take for granted that the prevention and wellness dollars are going to be there. We've gone through a major political shift. One of the parties right now is dedicated to repeal of health reform. Repeal and replacement is what's being said. That means defunding programs whenever possible. It means not providing administrative support wherever possible. So don't take it for granted. We need to advocate on behalf of people so that we have health reform. But when we have dollars for health reform, we need to make sure we spend them as effectively as possible to improve people's health and demonstrate how we've done it and get those demonstrations to our members of Congress so that they understand the good work that's going on. Why don't we start with the first question, and then we'll bunch of stay seated, and we'll just shout the answers out.
Thank you.
Please tell us who you are and where you come from.
My name is Marcia Rosenstein. I'm from California. I'm retired from the California Department of Public Health. Throughout this conversation all day, I haven't really heard the focus of all these federal funds, the new federal funds for prevention, which have not been heretofore available in years, go to the state and local health department in order to support public health infrastructure. In the last particularly few years during the economic recession, the states and localities have lost so much staff and capacity. And these new federal funds seem to be the only way to support the state and localities. And I'm wondering if anybody had any comments about assuming we can keep these funds coming,
right,
whether or not there is a mechanism to make it Congress and a system support the state and local health department.
We have to really work hard on this. Of the original $500 million this year that was allocated for prevention and wellness, you know, $250 million went to primary care. Important, but probably shouldn't have been taken from public health. Of that $250 million, about $75 million went into, quote, infrastructure grants to state and local governments. There is not necessarily, or let me put it differently, there is some reason to believe there are members of the administration who don't support investment in state and local public health infrastructure, and we are trying to get them as much information as we can so they'll advocate on behalf of state and local, and there clearly are instances in which Congress does not appreciate the importance of this. Much easier to focus on a given disease or condition, smoking, obesity, than it is to talk about infrastructure. Regina Benjamin talks about in that prevention council she has how, in fact, it wasn't HHS who raised the issue of the need for infrastructure. It was the folks who do radio and television, FCC, and transportation, who said, you need infrastructure. It wasn't HHS. So we have to make sure we document the need. And when the dollars come down, those $75 million now, we document not how we built more widgets or hired more people, but how services, essential services to Americans, were provided in the community and the congressional districts where that happened. So this is going to be a big challenge for us.
And you'll be working on it.
We're 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're working on it. So. Any other?
Well, I want to just make one comment.
You want to just yell from there?
No, I think that Paula said it extremely well. I think that so much of what's important for us is how we communicate. And I'm increasingly convinced that infrastructure is the wrong term. And, you know, capacity is a whole lot better. And I think we should try and change, you know, the nomenclature a little bit and say our ability to act to improve public health, but relate that to capacity or find some other term. Because I just think infrastructure just seems so diffuse and nebulous that I'm not sure that it really grabs most people, particularly in Congress, but also the public.
I actually asked Newt Gingrich this question 2 days ago. How do we protect the prevention of wellness dollars and the infrastructure? His response was, you need to come up with those five or six things you're asking to be invested in. If you get the money, what will happen in terms of the public's health, Andy said, and demonstrate how much money is going to be saved. I think it's good advice. We need to get much more disciplined about that. Please.
Yes, hi. Tony Sullivan, Tony Carroll, Tony Carroll's letter. This question raises a
really a lot of issues and questions in my mind, and I'm both very sorry for my transition to the session. But, you know, just talking for a brief about it, and I found that we heard mostly all day about the $15 billion that new health care reform legislation is going to provide the public health department, specifically for prevention, and how wonderful this is, and all these wonderful opportunities. And I certainly agree, but I know historically public health has not particularly been in a power position, to say the least. So the thing I'm hearing here is more a focus on what is the role and responsibility of the public health department in the coming year of this health care reform. How will we prosper, and what should we be focusing on? And so I guess I'm sort of looking in a nutshell for some people on contract at all, some of their application of where my head is right now, and asking them for the two wonderful programs that both of these professional women presented to us are sort of in the direction of how a lot of this going to go.
Well, I think insofar as HIV is concerned, the spirit of trying to address health equity, health reform, as well as the issues of the disease itself needs to be maintained. I guess I would argue that there are many elements in the HIV services that exist that could inform what a more robust health reform should look like. So when we think about housing assistance, when we think about legal assistance, when we think about those kinds of things that affect quality of life or one's ability to even make their appointment, like child care, those things need to be taken into account for all of health, not just HIV. And I think public health professionals are well suited to make those presentations in a meaningful way.
In terms of the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program, two things. One, with the patient care coordination demonstration grants that have gone to the 11 entities, the 11 states, I think this is a way of looking at what the national program has done well for a finite group of women. Remember, I said that we're probably reaching somewhere in the neighborhood of about almost 9% of women who are in need of screening. With this demonstration project, we're going beyond women who would be eligible for our program and looking at women who might not be eligible for anything else, who might be eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. So it's taking a look at what our program does well and how we can broaden our reach. I think that's very important.
I just gave you some sobering perspective. 15 million or billion sounds like a lot of money, but it represents about 2% of this health reform bill, consistent with how public health is funded in other ways. And even that we can't take for granted. We had Johanne's amendment tried to strip out that full $15 billion. The reason that failed is because they went for the whole enchilada. What we're going to see in the future are attempts to strip off 10 million here, you know, 100 million there, whatever it is, that will have a far greater chance of being successful than what Johanne's did to try to strip out all of it. So we really have to fight for this. These two examples are examples of very good public health programs that we should think about how do they go forward. But you're absolutely right to be thinking about what does public health look like in the future. The state and local public health departments have gone through structural downsizing and cuts. Essentially all have cut staff, essentially all have cut programs. We will never return to where we were. So we really have to think about what is it that's essential in the future. We won't be going back to where we were. So, please.
Hi, I'm Chris Hacker, and I'm a research director of health analyst at the National Institute of Health and in the National Institute of Nursing Research. My question is to capacity building. And right now, we have had several reports released by the IOM and the Robert Wood-Johnson Foundation on the future of nursing and future public health team, preserves development, everything, and there's a future of physicians. And right now, we are turning away, correct, I was just say, there was a call for nurses being the doctors of the future. I'm not sure anybody has seen this. I've been across a whole bunch of others. And I will say that there is a problem with attracting physicians into primary care. We know that, and there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. But we are turning away 47,000 qualified applicants to nursing schools right now because we do not have the infrastructure. We don't have enough PhD-trained nurses to teach or even other disciplines who are being attracted into teaching schools in nursing. And if there's something we can do, Dr. Pillion, as you had been talking about the past, specifically if you could address that. And I know the same thing applies to public health, and it's a real challenge. So we can throw money out there, but it's very fast.
We certainly need better models of care. Nurses have a broader role in that, and we shouldn't just look at the shortage of physicians. We need to look at the shortage of care, who should provide that care. I think that's the problem, that so much of what we do is categorical by discipline, which to me relates to the last issue of how we spend the $15 billion. If you look at how the world is organized, it's organized by disease and organ. NIH certainly is a prime example.
I would like to actually say that the Nursing Institute is actually the only institute that has cradle-to-grave research across the wellness through disease and end-of-life spectrum. And because of that, it makes it incredibly difficult for us to answer the reports that we have to do to Congress. Does anyone know how many of them have specific organs or specific disease or a slight
So what you can do, Chris, and everybody can do, is try and reorient those folks that are making the political decisions to help them understand that if they're really interested in the health of their children and their grandchildren, that they have to start thinking a little differently about what we do in terms of investment. I think that, you know, what Paul is saying about this $15 billion is very easy for everybody to say we need this much for kidney disease and we need this much for that. I mean, and all are important and all are worthy. But unless we start to take more holistic approaches, both to medical care delivery and to public health, we're not gonna get there. Public health has been funded for too long in categorical areas. But in terms of what Paul said about Newt Gingrich, I think it is critical that we be very concrete in terms of the kind of things we can do. And one of the differences now from 15 years ago is the issue of preparedness. Terrorism has to be on our minds, and we've been very fortunate not to have any incidents on our soil of significance to date, but I think most people in this field of counterterrorism don't think that's going to continue forever. I think our role as public health practitioners in prevention and response to different types of acts of terrorism and different issues there, and even in the prevention side, is really important. I can tell you in our department, one of the arguments we've made that has helped not have further erosion of staffing, even though we've had some reductions, is our role as a public safety agency. So we need to think about these hooks, if you will. So some politicians that were not particularly interested in public health or didn't have the same feel for it, but when you have the sheriff and you know others saying, you know, they're really key partners. When you have the FBI as a key partner, people think differently about public. I'm not saying we should turn ourselves inside out to say we're just a preparedness agency. We should use the attributes we have to talk to different constituencies.
So I'd like to return a challenge to the nurses. We do not have a center for public health nurses in the federal government. Nowhere. And actually Mary Wakefield's here, and we've asked her about that a number of times. Someone needs to represent public health nursing. Within the nursing profession, I've been to many presentations in which we hear that the bedside is the front line of nursing. And I would argue it's that nurse driving the four-wheeler drive up the track to a migrant farm workers that's at the front edge of nursing. So we need the nursing profession to recognize that public health nursing is an honorable profession where we need to put resources into. I don't see that, and we need it badly.
The confirmation of that is I am the only person here from the National
Yeah. Because
that's part of the official duty for NIH,
but I live in Paris, so I'm protection. Thank you. Please. Hi, my name is Wendy Lee, and I'm
from the NIH, but I'm from the NIH. Can we get you to pay for dinner tonight? Well, it's too early for health reform, but hopefully we will have some good public health systems and services research out there that's measuring the impact of health reform on both the health and the cost of health care. And hopefully NIH will be involved in that, as well as ARC and other agencies. We clearly need it. We also need much more research into translating the impact of public health programs into economic savings. We need more health economists helping us out, because what it comes down to, and I don't know if this is your experience, you can go in and testify in the legislature, and I've had them say to me, you know, that's fine. You're going to make these diabetics healthy. They're going to live longer. That's going to cost us more money. So we need to figure out how to convince people that our public health programs are a solution to our health care crisis. Let me guess. Community health workers.
We all agree on the panel the importance of community health workers. I'm just going to tell you one story from our own experience. We have a women's health program in Los Angeles County, and we've had women, primarily women from different ethnic communities who can speak the different languages. We have at least 12 languages that are spoken by substantial numbers, and actually over 100 languages by significant numbers. We were trying to get calls in to, in fact, get cervical and breast cancer screening, and we had appointments available and the like, and only when we could do advertising on the radio could we get calls in, because how else would people know about it? Most people aren't spending their time surfing the web and looking at public health. So what the head of this program did was take the people off the phones and have them go into their communities. So into the Chinese community or into the Vietnamese community or into the Korean community, whatever, and to use the, so in essence, as community health workers, even though they don't have a particular background, and the increase in the throughput for these screening services is remarkable. So you're absolutely right. We need to find, and we use them in a number of different ways, but I'm not sure we standardize kind of in a sense. I do know this, that because of the nursing shortage, nurses are very expensive. And so for the price of one very valuable public health nurse, and I do want to say they're valuable, we can hire over two, maybe two and a half community health workers. So we have to really understand what the trade-offs are and who can do what. So I'm really glad you brought up that point. They have to be an important part of the team, as we have very diverse communities, and we have people with great expertise in how to motivate people within those communities and to help them in ways that are much less threatening than most healthcare professionals.
Thank you. Well, we are out of time. Thank you very much for coming, and there'll be more opportunity to speak through the week.